You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 193 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Problems of Society, An Esoteric View from Luciferic Past to Ahrimanic Future, translated by Matthew Barton, 9 lectures. This is Lecture 2, given in Bern on the 8th of February, 1919. The public lectures I have been giving deal with the social problem, the social needs of today, not just as a theoretical appraisal shows them to be, but as they actually manifest in the realities and occurrences of modern life in the world. Anthroposophy can shed further light on all these things relating to human life, which nowadays require reflection of the broadest possible kind and in the widest possible circles. If we feel ourselves to be part of the anthroposophic movement, we ought never to forget the vital importance of considering everything in the world, all outward phenomena, as something requiring further penetration by insights drawn from the world of spirit. Everything acquires its proper aspect of reality only when we are able to conceive it as pervaded by spirit, by an essence which is initially invisible within the external earthly world, but which, nevertheless, really does live in this world. When I was here with you last time, I made some remarks from an anthroposophic perspective about the social impulses at work in human life. We were trying to consider the human being as a social being, with both social and anti-social instincts. But we must never overlook the fact that as earthly human beings, we introduce into earthly life effects that are the outcome of experiences we have between death and a new birth. Into each life, we lead, here we bring the fruits of our previous sojourn in worlds of spirit, in a purely supersensible world. And in fact, we cannot fully comprehend this earthly life of ours if we do not remember that whatever we do here, what occurs here in the world, in our coexistence with others, at the same time bears something of the signature of effects brought about by our life in the world of spirit, from which we emerge at birth, and whose traces and powers we bring with us into this life. On the one hand, we have here what originates in the world of spirit for us, and informs our life in the physical world. But there is another aspect, too. In the life we lead on earth, things happen that we are not initially fully conscious of, that happens to us and around us, without us taking real cognizance of them. And yet it is these experiences particularly, which remain in our subconscious during life between birth and death, which are of the utmost importance when we carry them with us through the portal of death into the supersensible world, leaving the earthly world again. There are many things that happen during our life on earth that are not of direct importance for this life itself, but instead are significant as preparation for our life after death. I am making a distinction here, therefore, between life before birth and life after death. My reflections in yesterday's public lecture are of a kind that only come to full and detailed clarity if we also know how to illumine them with the light drawn from the supersensible world. Today, therefore, I want to study this highly topical theme in more depth with the help of anthroposophic insights. I wish to consider the social problem as a problem of all humanity. However, humanity in its totality is for us not just the sum of souls who are living at any one time in social coexistence upon the earth, but also includes those who, at the same time, are living in the supersensible world, for they are connected by spiritual bonds to those on earth. And, together, they form the full scope of humanity. Let us therefore first reflect on what we call human culture, in an earthly sense, the life of the human spirit. In its earthly meaning, human culture, or spiritual life, is not the life of spiritual beings, but something humankind experiences together in its social coexistence. This cultural life includes, above all, everything that encompasses science, art, and religion. At the same time, it likewise includes everything that relates to schooling and education. We will therefore first consider what human beings experience as cultural life in their social coexistence. From what I said yesterday, you will have gathered that this life of the human spirit, all schooling, education, all science, art, literary life, and so forth, must take shape in its own distinct sphere of society. To make clear to the outer world why this is so, we have to formulate it in ways that this outer world itself can accept. It is clear that healthy human common sense has to be sufficient to fully fathom these things, although we can only gain a really tangible sense of them if we embrace an anthroposophic view of the world. If we do, then what is called human culture appears in a very distinctive light. Modern developments have led this cultural life to fall under the sway of an intellectual bourgeoisie and become diluted into mere ideology. The proletariat have adopted this schematic ideology into their worldview, in which all the realms I listed above arise simply from economic factors. The proletarian worldview today pictures things roughly in the following terms: all religious conviction and religious ideas, all artistic accomplishments, all views of justice and morality are, they say, a superstructure, something like a spiritual puff of smoke that ascends from the only true reality, that of economics. In these terms, human culture on earth becomes mere ideology, something that is simply conceived intellectually. But for someone acquainted with the foundations on which anthroposophically oriented spiritual science originates, the cultural and spiritual life in which human beings are embedded as a gift of beings of spirits themselves. In this view, it does not simply rise up like mist from underground economic factors, but streams down instead from the life of the spiritual hierarchies. An intellectual view of the world, developing from the 15th and 16th centuries, and its legacy in the proletarian outlook, according to which the spiritual world is an ideological construct, a vaporous emanation from harmonious and disharmonious economic factors, is radically different from the worldview that must now make headway, which alone will bring healing and lead us out of the chaos of modern life. In this outlook, we can draw on the world's true life of spirit, which descends to us, streams down upon us. We belong to this world just as fully as we belong to the earthly, physical world through our senses and rational mind. And now, in the fifth post-Atlantean epoch, we can only find our way into the human social organism as social beings, can only embed this life of spirit there, because of preparations we undertake for this earthly human culture before birth, before we descended to earthly existence, entering there into relationship with other spirit beings of the hierarchies, as we have often described. At birth, we enter into relationship with other human beings in two ways, and it is important to distinguish these clearly. One of these is to do with our destiny connections with others. We are drawn to one person or another, to a larger or smaller number of people in a destined context. Entering earthly existence at birth, we come to a particular family, to father, mother, siblings, and the wider family around us. This is given as our destiny. We also enter as individuals into destined connections with other individuals, living out the karma we have with them. How does this karma arise? How do these connections of destiny come about? They arise, or were prepared, by factors and circumstances that existed in our previous life on earth. Let's be clear about this. Through birth, you enter into relationship with others. You connect as one individual with other individuals, and live out the destiny that corresponds to your life with these individuals in previous lives on earth. This is one way in which you enter into relationships with others, through destined connections. But you develop other relationships too. You belong to a group of people who together form a nation, and you are not connected with all of them by destiny. You are born into a particular race and nation, into a particular territory, as it were. No doubt this is also to do with your karma, yet at the same time, it means that you are forged into a social organism with many others to whom you do not intrinsically belong by destiny. In a religious community, too, you may share the same religious feelings or sensibility with many others with whom, however, you do not have a common destiny at all. Cultural life on earth creates the most diverse social and communal contexts between people without these all being rooted in destiny. These connections and contexts are not all prepared in advance in previous lives, but instead in the period you pass through between death and a new birth, especially toward the second half of this life after death, when the prospect of a new birth arises. Then you enter into a relationship with beings, above all of the higher hierarchies, and are influenced by their powers in a way that melds you spiritually with diverse groups of human beings. The spiritual, cultural life you experience in the context of religion, art, nation, or even by virtue of sharing a common language, or through a very specific form of education, and so on, is all prepared in pre-birth life, but in a way that is distinct from purely karmic factors. At birth, you bring with you into physical life on earth what you previously experienced in your pre-birth life. And these pre-birth experiences come to expression in cultural life, the life of spirit, in this earthly realm, albeit in a quite different way from how you experienced them before birth. A very specific question will arise here for someone who is able to give all due seriousness to this kind of spiritual reality. How do we rightly serve this earthly culture of ours, in a higher sense, when we know that it is an earthly reflection of what we actually experienced in our spiritual existence before birth? We can only properly serve it if, instead of regarding it as ideology, we know that the world of spirit indwells it. We only develop the right stance toward this life of earthly culture if we are aware that the powers of the world of spirit are everywhere active within it. Take it as an hypothesis, if you like, that the thoughts of beings of spirit belonging to the supersensible world, whether beings of the higher hierarchies who never assume an earthly body, or unborn human beings who have not yet entered upon their future life at birth, are alive, that their soul life lives in a kind of dream reflection within our earthly culture. And so it is quite legitimate for us to ask ourselves, what lives in any artistic or religious or educational impulse that we encounter? We do not meet here something that humankind has simply created on earth, but rather something that lives in it, streams into it from powers, thoughts, impulses, from the whole soul life of the higher hierarchies. We never see the world in its entirety if we deny that our earthly culture is informed by the reflected thoughts of spirit beings not embodied on the earth, who either are never embodied or are not so at present. If we can acquire a feeling of the sacred nature of the world of spirit as the gift of spirit beings all around us who compose the spiritual world, then we can find a due sense of gratitude for these supersensible gifts which we experience as our earthly culture. And then this spirit-born world of culture will inevitably find its proper and necessary place in humanity's whole social organism as the furtherance of what we ourselves participate in before birth in the world of spirit. If we illumine the life of society through spiritual insight, it becomes self-evident that this cultural life of ours must have a distinct and autonomous reality. The second sphere of society can be called the external legislative state or political life in its narrower sense. Everything that relates to legal relationships between people, in which all are equal before the law. This is the life of nationhood, of the state, which should comprise no more than this. Here again, certainly, our healthy common sense can show us the need for this state legislature, this life of public justice, which concerns the equality of all before the law, the equal rights of all human beings, to be an autonomous sphere of the social organism. And yet we can become aware of something quite different, too, in this domain, if we study it with vision made keener by anthroposophic spiritual science. This sphere of law and justice is the only domain in society which has nothing to do either with pre-birth or after-death existence. It is an order and orientation established only in the world in which we live between birth and death. Only to this degree is the state archetypally a self-contained whole, as long as it does not impinge on anything that in some way relates to the supersensible world, whether looking back to pre-birth life or forward to life after death. Quote, "Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's." Close quote. But we can make this still clearer by adding, quote, "Do not render unto Caesar the things that are God's, nor unto God the things that are Caesar's." Close quote. In both cases, they will be repudiated. We need to clearly and cleanly distinguish these things in the same way that different systems in the natural human organism are kept separate. Everything which the state encompasses, which can be discussed and agreed at a legislative level, relates solely to the social coexistence of human beings. That is the important thing, and deeper religious sensibilities have invariably felt this throughout history. Others, not gifted with a deep religious nature, did not even allow people to discuss these matters freely and honestly because of a conviction that took root in those of deeper religious sensibility. The latter knew that the state only encompasses the life between birth and death, all that concerns merely earthly existence. And it is a bad thing when earthly concerns seek to extend their reach and dominion to the supersensible realm, to what lies before birth and after death. Earthly human culture is something that originates beyond birth and death, for it contains shadows, reflections of the soul experiences of supersensible beings. When impulses, living in the life of rites and legislature, sought to take over the life of spirituality on earth, of human culture, people of deeper religious sensibility saw this as a power exercised or usurped by the iniquitous prince of this world. This phrase, quote, the iniquitous prince of this world, close quote, relates to what I have now described. And this was also why the circles interested in confounding and confusing the three distinct spheres of the social organism do not like hearing it spoken and frown upon this expression. Something different, again, holds true in our thinking, feeling, and inner impulses insofar as we are evolved in the economic sphere of the social organism. There is something very curious and distinctive here, though by now schooled as you are in anthroposophically oriented spiritual science, you will be used to grappling with seemingly paradoxical realities. When we speak of the economic sphere of the social organism, we have to be clear that in the terms we mean now, it is characteristic of the fifth post-Atlantean epoch only. In former ages of humanity's evolution, these things were different. What I have to say, therefore, relates to our life today and in future. In earlier times, humankind engaged more instinctively in economic life, whereas now this must become ever more conscious. As I have said previously, in the same way that we learn our times tables in primary school and other basic things, in future we will have to learn at school the things that relate to the social organism, to economic life. We have to be able to feel that we are a part of the economic organism. Naturally, some will find this uncomfortable, since they are used to other habits of thought and feeling, and these habits must change entirely. If someone today does not know what 3 times 9 is, he will be considered uneducated. In some circles, you will be thought uneducated if you do not know who Raphael or Leonardo was. But you are not generally regarded as uneducated if you are unable to define the nature of capital, production, consumption, and the way these interrelate, or what the credit system and banking involves, and so on. Not to mention the fact that very few people indeed have any clear idea of the meaning of a, quote, Lombard business, close quote, and such like. As social conditions change, these concepts will no doubt change too, and it will become easier in future to seek and find clarification of such matters. Nowadays, people feel rather flummoxed if they try to fathom economics. Picking up a book on economics by an acknowledged expert in the field, for what could be more natural when trying to understand the subject, you will be confused to find that different economists all give quite different definitions of capital. What would you think about the subject of geometry if you were to read 3 books about it and find that the theorem of Pythagoras is presented quite differently in each? Even acknowledged authorities on economics seem unable to clarify their subject, and one can therefore scarcely find fault with the general public for failing to seek more insight. But insight will be needed. People will have to build a bridge that connects them with the economic structures of the social organism. They will have to integrate themselves, their subjective existence, into economic life, into the social organism. They will have to learn to think about how they relate to others in this realm simply by virtue of the fact that they engage economically with others in a particular territory in relation to all kinds of goods and commodities. The thinking we develop here, informed by our whole relationship with the natural world, is quite different in kind from, say, the thinking that develops in the world of human culture. in this other realm of spirit and culture, you gain an experience of the thinking of beings of the higher hierarchies, and of what you yourself experienced in your pre-birth life. In the thinking you develop as a participant in the economic struggle for survival, as paradoxical as this may seem, another person, a deeper person, is always thinking alongside and within you. Specifically, when you feel yourself to be part of an economic entity, a deeper person is thinking in you and alongside you. Here, with your thinking, you are obliged to compile and conflate diverse factors of outward life. What will the right price be for this or that? How do I obtain one or another commodity? And so forth. Here your thoughts, in a sense, flit from one outward fact to the next, and your thinking is not informed by spirit, but by outward material things. And it is precisely because outward material factors live in your thinking, which has to be alert here to what is happening in economic life, and not merely instinctual experience as in the animal, that you can say that another deeper human being is continually thinking within you about these things. He is the one who perpetuates these thoughts, creating connections between them and giving them a provisional conclusion. And this deeper person within you is an essential participant in everything you carry with you into the world of spirit at death. However paradoxical it may seem to many, consideration of material factors we are obliged to engage in here in the world, which are never finished and never come to a final conclusion, stimulates in us another inner spiritual life that we carry through death into the supersensible world. Thus the feelings and impulses we develop in economic life have a closer connection with our life after death than is commonly realized. This may seem very strange and paradoxical, and yet it is simply a more conscious version of what entered human instincts from the world of spirit in atavistic eras of human evolution, and developed in humankind back then. Let me clarify this with the following thoughts. In certain indigenous tribes, you can discover very striking social arrangements. Now, we must not entertain the nonsensical and foolish idea about such tribes that modern anthropologists propound. The latter think that these tribes, the Aborigines in Australia, for instance, are a throwback to humanity's earliest stages, and that modern, in quotes, civilized peoples once originated from such a state. This is nonsense. In fact, these indigenous tribes represent an element that has lapsed from an earlier condition. The only difference between these tribes and supposedly civilized peoples is that they have retained aspects of their earlier condition, whereas in so-called civilized people, this has been masked or overlaid. For this reason, we can study in indigenous peoples much that once existed in humankind at times of atavistic clairvoyance, when, for example, the following social arrangements existed. The members of a particular tribe formed small groups, each of which had a certain name taken from a plant or animal of that region. This delineation of smaller groups within larger social contexts was connected with the following. One group, say, but here we will use modern names just to clarify what I mean, bore the name Rye, R-Y-E, and this group had to ensure that rye was properly cultivated, so that other groups, not called rye, could be supplied with the grain. Thus these people had to supervise rye cultivation and distribution, while other groups with different names could depend on supplies of rye from them. Another group might be called cattle, and had the task of husbanding cows, supplying produce from them to the other groups. Besides supplying the product for which they were responsible, as designated by their names, At the same time, it was forbidden for other groups to cultivate a product not assigned to them. This was the, in quotes, totemic right, as it was called, of each group. This is the economic meaning of totem, which was at the same time part and parcel of a mystery culture in the regions where these totemic practices existed. Mystery culture was not, as modern people imagine, something altogether lofty and removed from daily life, but drawn from the resolves of the gods, which participants in the mysteries could decipher. It played into the smallest everyday details of existence as a socially organizing influence. It ordered the tribe according to totemic forms, totemic groups, and thus brought about a corresponding economic order. At the same time, in specific ways, it disclosed to people the intrinsic nature of the world of spirit, showing how this world enters into and informs earthly culture in a way that was appropriate at the time, as well as governance through the life of rites, with its solely earthly character. People here on earth prepared themselves through their economic arrangements and institutions so that at death they could once again enter a world in which they must develop connections that they could only previously prepare on earth through their engagement with the non-human elements of nature. These ancient tribes learned, through the guidance of their initiates, to include in their life on earth a sphere of economics with its due relationship to the cosmos. Later, this grew less and less clearly distinguished, although it is not too difficult to trace an instinctive threefolding of the social organism up to ancient Greece and even into medieval culture, and in its vestiges, discernible up to the 18th century. Ah, modern people think in such superficial ways. They prefer things to be presented so easily and comfortably. A deeper study of former times, rather than commonly accepted legends that nowadays make up much of what is thought to be history, will show that threefolding was practiced instinctively, and that in one sphere of the social organism, that of spiritual life, everything originated from a spiritual center and was thus separate and distinct from state governance. When the Catholic Church was at its height, it created an autonomous sphere, which in turn organized the rest of earthly culture as an autonomous domain, founding schools, organizing education, including the first universities. It made earthly culture autonomous, ensuring that the state was not pervaded by the iniquitous prince of this world. And in economic life, even in later times, a sense at least prevailed of a fraternity between people as a preparation for something that will be perpetuated in the life after death. The idea that brotherliness will be rewarded after death is in fact an egotistic reinterpretation of the higher insights that once lived in totemism, but shows at least some residual awareness that fraternal life in human economics will be perpetuated in a realm of spirit after death. Even perversions in this realm must be judged from the same perspective. They lie in human nature. The medieval sale of indulgences was one of the worst excesses, and yet it too sprang from an awareness that the economic sacrifice a person makes here in physical life has significance for his life after death. Although a caricature of the truth, it was a caricature originating in a true perception of what we experience when we relate on earth to the natural realms of the minerals, plants, and animals. By entering into relationship with other creatures, we acquire something that only fully unfolds in life after death. As far as our after-death condition is concerned, you see, we are still related here to lower forms of life, to animals, plants, and minerals. And precisely in this experience of non-human entities, we prepare something that will only grow up into our human nature after death. Our experience of animals, plants, and minerals is an encompassing element for us on earth, surrounding us like a spiritual atmosphere within the earthly realm. Whereas what people experience amongst each other is the basis only for a purely etheric element between birth and death. What we experience below the human level in economic life only becomes human as such, is only raised into an earthly human element once we have crossed the threshold of death. For someone with an anthroposophic orientation, who seeks to deepen his insights into life through anthroposophy, this ought to be of the very greatest interest. To acknowledge that this threefold social organism is tangibly founded in our own threefold being, and this because we bear something with us of what we experienced before birth, as we grow into the physical world in childhood, and bear also in us something that only has meaning between birth and death, and as it were, below the veil of ordinary physical life, prepares something that will have meaning in our supersensible existence after death. What appears here as the lowest realm of life, you see, our life in the physical economy, which seems of a lower order than the sphere of rights and justice, nevertheless compensates us by gaining time for us to prepare ourselves for life after death as we engage in, quotes, lower economic activity. In our soul's participation in art, religious life, education, and other forms of culture, we consume the inheritance which we bring with us at birth into earthly physical life. But by lowering ourselves in a sense below the human level, through economic life, into a realm of thinking that does not raise itself so high, we are compensated by preparing in our deepest self something that only after death will raise itself to the human level. This may still sound paradoxical to modern ears, since people nowadays see things so narrowly and reject any sense that everything in life has two aspects. Something lofty from one perspective is of a lower order from another. Everything in life really has two aspects, and we would gain better insights into ourselves and the world if we were aware of this. Sometimes it feels uncomfortable to entertain such a thought in its full scope, for it imposes various duties on us. For instance, we have to practice a degree of cleverness in certain respects. But actually, we cannot develop the necessary acuity without at the same time developing an equal measure of stupidity in another direction. The one always incurs the other. Really, we ought never to think a person completely stupid, even if he appears so in outward life, without being aware that a deep, though concealed wisdom may lie in his subconscious. Reality only comes into focus before us if we take full account of its dual aspect. The life of spirit and culture appears to us to be very lofty on the one hand, but at the same time it is the realm in which we are actually always practicing theft, consuming what we bring into physical existence at birth. Economic life seems to us to be the lowest aspect of human activity, but this is only because it reveals its lowest aspect here, between birth and death. In fact, it allows us the time to develop unconsciously the spiritual aspect of economic life, which we bear into supersensible realms at death. And what I mean, primarily, by the spiritual aspect of economic life is a sense of commonality and community with other human beings. It is an urgent necessity that humanity should understand these things if it is to emerge from certain calamities arising precisely from the fact that no account has been taken of them. Amongst leading members of the ruling intelligentsia, something has emerged, I spoke of this the day before yesterday, which does not have sufficient impetus to enter daily life. It is particularly important for us today to acquire the right understanding of this. You see, the ruling intellectual classes of society have developed a certain moral worldview, a certain religious outlook. Yet this is a moral religious outlook that they prefer to cultivate in a narrowly idealistic manner, and which therefore does not gain the momentum to enter ordinary daily life. Attending church Sunday after Sunday, and perhaps more frequently, you will hear sermons which continually avoid grappling with the most pressing tasks of our day. You will hear all kinds of things you are urged to do in accordance with a religious worldview, but it has no purchase on reality. Then, leaving the church and once more entering daily life, you find it impossible to put into practice these sermons about love between human beings, about how you should live your life. How can you forge a connection between what the preacher or moral instructor says to his flock and the conditions actually prevailing in daily life? Things were different in this respect in the days when the totemic rites held sway. In those times, the initiates arranged life in accordance with the counsel of the gods. An unhealthy state of affairs, existing today, comes to expression in the fact that sermons in church say nothing about economic life and how it should be organized. What is preached from the pulpit, I have often used this simile, is like looking at a stove and saying to it, quote, "Stove, you stand here in the room. In your position relative to the other objects in this room, it is your sacred duty to heat the room. Fulfill this sacred duty, therefore, and make the room warm." Close quote. You can stand there preaching to the stove as long as you like, but the room will stay cold. Instead of preaching, you will be better advised to fetch wood or coal, place it in the stove and light it. Then the room will warm up. In other words, it would be better to leave aside all moral sermons to people to behave in ways that will bring them eternal bliss or such like, which simply appeal to their faith. Sermons are not essential, but what is essential is to cultivate real insight into the social organism. That would be the proper task of all who wish to instruct the populace. To build a bridge, also quite practically, from the living spirit which infuses everything to what actually happens in daily life. You see, God, the divine, does not only live in what people dream in rarefied heights, but also in the tiniest detail of the everyday. The divine is present when you pick up the salt cellar from the table, when you bring a spoonful of soup to your mouth, when you buy something from someone else for 5 pence. You contradict the inmost significance of a worldview which truly accords with reality if you regard one aspect of life as merely material, tangible, and lower in nature, and the other as divine spirit that must be kept nice and separate from the material and tangible realm. When you see the one as sacred and the other as profane, what you need instead is to find the impetus that draws the highest and most sacred down into the most ordinary everyday human experiences. Religion has developed in a way that fails to do this. It preaches to the stove to get hot, but avoids engaging in real, tangible spirit knowledge. It would be very beneficial if people were to express this, state it clearly, that those who feel called upon to instruct others in spiritual matters actually fail to connect one realm with the other. Stating this would show the direction we need to go in. How do people talk nowadays about redemption, grace, and all the articles of faith? They do so in a very easy and comfortable way. Here we have people with their human sensibilities. Once upon a time, Christ Jesus died at Golgotha, and, though progressive theologians no longer believe this, was resurrected. But he did or does this all by himself, and people need do no more than believe in it. That's the view of many nowadays. and they regard it as an annoyance if anyone thinks differently. But we have to learn to think differently. A radical renewal is needed specifically in this domain. We can put it like this. The admonishment of Christ, or also already of John the Baptist, is once again resonant for us today. Quote, change your ways, for the time of crisis is near at hand. Close quote. People have become used to somehow assuming the Spirit exists in some realm where it takes care of them, to relying on preachers who tell of the existence of a world of spirit, but fail to describe it in any real way. People do not wish to exert their thinking enough to gain knowledge of the world of spirit, but are happy simply to believe in it. But the time has passed when this may be. A time must begin now, when people have to know and not just believe things. Not just, quote, I think and maybe I also think about the supersensible occasionally, close quote. But, quote, I must allow divine spiritual powers to enter my thinking and feeling. The world of spirit must live in me. My thoughts themselves must be divine in nature. I must give God an opportunity to express himself through me. Close quote. Then the life of spirit and culture will not remain mere ideology. That is the great sin of modern times. That culture and spirit have been diluted, weakened, into ideology. Theology itself, and not just socialism, is now ideological. But people must recover from this ideology, so that the spiritual world becomes reality for them. They need to know that the world of spirit lives as reality in one sphere of the social organism, as the legacy of pre-birth life. The world of spirit, and that another aspect of spirit is in preparation as we seemingly descend to lower realms and interact with other human beings in economic life. In this realm specifically, something is being prepared as balance to this submergence, which, when we enter the world of spirit again at death, will lead us in turn, if we fully and properly experience it, to more humane and fraternal knowledge here on earth. We need to start seeing life's reality again. We place ourselves into the world in the right way as anthroposophists if we realize that things humanity needs today can be deepened by developing spiritual science, not just as theory, but as something that penetrates all our feelings, pervading and transforming our whole sense of life, rendering it worthy to participate in what must now begin in our times, and what alone will create wellsprings for humanity's future. What has been omitted, and what is needed, only by engaging fearlessly and courageously with things that have been omitted, and what is needed, can anything healing for the present and near future come about? It is for this reason that I have tried here, in this more intimate circle, to add anthroposophic perspectives of a deeper kind to what one can say in public about the social problem, including here aspects of the immortal, supersensible life of disembodied human souls in their interaction with earthly life. Only one sphere of the social organism, relating to the state's outward organization, is purely earthly. The two other spheres are quickened by two aspects of super-terrestrial reality. On the one hand, we have an earthly cultural life with which we are endowed as a superfluity, garnered in a sense from a pre-birth super-terrestrial life of spirit. And on the other hand, as corporeal human beings, and as such connected with the other creatures of the earth, we must submerge ourselves in merely economic activity. But we are not only corporeal. Within this body of ours, the soul is being prepared for subsequent lives on earth and subsequent supersensible life. In economic life, something is being prepared that will raise a part of us that is not yet wholly human, the part of us that must be embedded in economic life, into the domain of the human. Within us, in a sense, we bear a partly superhuman aspect, insofar as we can move toward a social context that is interwoven with earthly culture, with spirit on earth. We bear something merely human in us as citizens of the state, and we bear in us something that compels us to descend below both these, which the world of spirit at the same time compensates us for, however, by preparing within this apparently lowest sphere of social experience something that will in turn lead us back and reintegrate us with the supersensible. Reality is not superficial enough to be easily comprehended, even though many would prefer it to be so. Human life passes through the most diverse phases, and at each phase, new momentum, new ingredients, new impulses enter life that can only emerge in the particular realms where they are given. We can observe how the threads of life, which we spin here between birth and death, are interwoven with the threads spun in the life between death and rebirth. Everything is meaningfully interwoven in this totality of human life. The threads spun between one human individual and another here in earthly life. What we do to someone by giving him pleasure, by inflicting an injury on him, by enriching his thoughts or impoverishing them, by teaching him something or other, prepares our karmic destiny in a subsequent life on earth. But we must distinguish this from what we need in order to prepare ourselves for supersensible existence immediately after death. Here on earth we are led into certain social communities from which we must be led forth once more. We are led forth from them by virtue of the fact that something surfaces from our merely economic activities, from mere economics, that guides us through the portal of death into the world of spirit, so that we do not remain in the social community we found our way into here, but can depart from it and be received into another in our next life. In this very meaningful way, the karmic weft connecting us here is interwoven with the warp of our more general life in the cosmos. Insights we can gain from spiritual science about the ways in which supersensible life is connected with physical life on earth inform our understanding of the threefold social organism, substantially deepening the more exoteric content of this view. Naturally, this is hard for others outside anthroposophy to comprehend, and there's nothing to be done about that. But within the anthroposophic movement, we should look beyond earthly considerations and reasoning to encompass at the same time all that connects us with the sphere we enter at death, from which we came at birth, and in which we must seek those with whom we have certain connections who have passed before us from this earthly world. Deepening our insights into life through anthroposophy will lead to this finest of human achievements, an understanding of the two great mysteries of earthly life, birth and death, and the building of a bridge between sensory and supersensible reality, between the so-called living and the so-called dead. Then the dead can live amongst us, and we can see that life in the supersensible realm, which was ours before birth and will be ours again after death, is nothing other than a different form of existence. This existence is, in quotes, dead as far as sensory reality is concerned, just as sensory reality is dead while we live in the supersensible realm. Everything in the world is related and interwoven. And only when we understand these two aspects of every reality can we fully fathom it. I wanted to offer these thoughts today to enlarge on more esoteric aspects of issues we so urgently need to discuss in public. It is very important that people close to the anthroposophic movement should participate in these public debates. And that is the end of the lecture. There is an answer to a question right after it. It says here, in reply to a question that was not recorded, Rudolf Steiner added, here he is again, this view of the social organism is, one can really say, a firm foundation. We simply have to study how it can be integrated with reality in each specific instance. If you know Pythagoras's theorem, you will not ask how it is justified in every single instance. When you know it, then you also know it holds true wherever it is applicable, just as 3 times 10 is always 30, however you apply this knowledge. There will be no need to ask if it is correct in principle, nor will you have to keep proving it. You just have to recognize the truth of it yourself. In the same way, in relation to this view of society, we start from a certain firm foundation that is simply true, and other things will follow and relate to this primary insight in the right way. The tax system, the capital ownership system, everything will accord with this primary insight. All this will become clear if we comprehend the nature of the living social organism. And so, for instance, people will not hold back from sending their children to the free Waldorf school. On the contrary, they will want to send them. They will have an interest in doing so. And likewise, in the sphere where each person develops a relationship with every other, the rights sphere, it is necessary to form correct judgments. And no one could be elected to join a representatives' association of this second sphere of the social organism without this capacity for judgment. Naturally, this has to be checked. But relationships between people, this active interest, this conscious involvement in life, is something that will certainly be self-sustaining in the free and ever healthier social organism. The end of Lecture 2.